Just a quick note to our presenters. We're waiting on a couple of representatives who are running just a couple minutes late. We appreciate your patience.
Good afternoon, members of the House Transportation Committee who have decided to join us today. Thank you very much. Before we get started, I'd like to remind everybody in the room to please silence your phone. And if you're on either the Teams meetings or on your phone as a presenter, please make sure you mute yourself when you are not speaking. Today is April 26th, 2021, and it is 1:07 in the p.m. Present with us today so far are Representative Sponholz, Representative Drummond, Vice Chair Hannon, and myself, Chair Hopkins. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Jamie Buhner, and our LIO moderator, Kelsey Riker. Thank you very much for your assistance today. For those listening at home, all of today's presentations can be found by visiting the akleg.gov website and finding today's hearings under the Daily Schedule tab. And if there's documents available on there, it should be clearly present on the documents list. Representative McKay has joined us at 1:08 p.m. Thank you, Representative McKay. Today we'll be hearing from the administration regarding proposed regulations 2021-2079, ATVs and snow machines use of roadways. On behalf of the House Transportation Committee, I would like to honestly and sincerely thank the administration for participating in today's hearing and making available for comments and questions. Today, we will be hearing from Deputy Commissioner of Administration, Dave Donnelly, Deputy Department of Motor Vehicles Director, Jenna Wright, and Deputy Public Safety Commissioner, Leon Morgan. Also want to let the record note that we are joined by Representative Kronk and Representative McCabe at 1:09. Thank you, gentlemen. At this time, my staff, Joe Hardenbrook, will go over what's in your packet and at your seat when you arrive today.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. Just for the information of the committee, there's a couple of documents that came in.
Use the mic.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. Just for the information of the committee, there's a couple of documents that came in late in the day that I've printed off and provided hard copies for the members of the committee. First off is two letters that were sent to the Transportation Committee email address weighing in on the regulations. Second, there is a two-page document provided by the administration detailing the process for the regulations. finally, there is the second page of that packet will be a one-page write-up from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities detailing some information about the proposed regulations, just for your information. Additionally, there is, just in case folks didn't get one, a hard copy of Dr. Bell's presentation with numbered page numbers at the bottom. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hardenborough. As we're all aware, these proposed regulations were submitted for public comment last month and have generated a significant amount of public interest. For example, my hometown alone, the newspaper and the radio stations have seen a number of letters to the editor and stories regarding this topic coming from citizens, organizations, and local governments across the state who are also submitting comments and questions to the administration. I would like to note for the committee today, the hearing is being held under the auspices of the Administrative Procedures Act. This may limit the questions we can ask and might prevent some of the state officials here today from answering some of the questions while the proposed regulations are still open for comment. As an example, asking implementation questions of the regulations is well within the bounds of the Administrative Procedures Act, but asking the departments and administration to comment on the regulations is something that they are not as open to doing. So we'll work together to make sure questions are inbounds, but don't be hesitant and be brave, and we'll make sure the questions get asked in a way that is answerable. I appreciate the committee and the administration's patience as we work our way through this topic today. First, we will hear from the administration and engage in a question and answer session after their opening statements, as I believe they have some to read for the record. Those opening statements will be available for clarification questions from us and based on what the administration says. After those opening statements, we'll go into that question and answer session where we'll be discussing the implementation of the regulations, how it can impact your community at home, the different powers your community has, different insurance requirements, things like that. Following that question and answer session, we will then hear presentation from Dr. Nathan Bells, a civil engineer and transportation safety expert at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It is the intent of the chair to allow each member of the administration with us today to make a statement, if they so choose, and then begin our question and answer session. Are there any questions about this from members of the committee before we get a start? All right, looks like we're good to go there. So we're going to go ahead and first start with Mr. Donnelly. Mr. Donnelly, are you online and have any comments and opening statements for the committee? Please put yourself on the record and start your comments.
Mr. Chairman, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir, loud and clear.
Yeah, I'm Dave Donnelly. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Administration. I'm one of the Deputy Commissioners. I thank you for your invitation to testify today on these regulations. Good afternoon to the members of the committee and yourself. The Department of Public Safety and the Department of Administration have issued a joint statement regarding these proposed regulations, which the committee has been provided, as the chair referenced. That statement acknowledges that Alaska has one of the nation's highest per capita ownership rates of all-terrain vehicles and off-highway vehicles, snow machines, side-by-sides, utility terrain vehicles, and other all-purpose vehicles. And as these vehicles are very popular with Alaskans, affording Alaskans the opportunity to own them to engage in hunting, fishing, and subsistence activities, as well as motorized recreation. Other states, including Arizona, Idaho, Montana, South Dakota, and Wyoming, have provided the owners of some of these types of vehicles, not all of them, with the option to make their machines street legal and operable on public roads. And so the goal of the administration was to provide Alaskans with the greatest opportunity to safely and affordably travel throughout the state. And the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Administration have proposed these regulations together that would allow Alaskans to legally operate their ATVs or snowmobiles on roads with speed limits of 45 miles per hour or less. Vehicle owners would be required to follow all current applicable statutes and regulations while operating on roadways, and that includes being properly licensed and insured. The proposed regulations would also require vehicles to be equipped with safety equipment, including headlights, brakes, mufflers, and brake lights, while operating on public roads. Local governments would be empowered to opt out of the provisions for roads within their jurisdiction. And I'd like to just emphasize that these are proposed draft regulations, and public comment is welcome and being encouraged. And the regulations have been publicly posted online and open to public comment. The Department of Public Safety's proposed regulations are open to public for public comment until April 18th. And at the Department of Administration, our regulations are open for public comment until April 15th. And we, as the chair rightfully pointed out, we're currently in an active public comment period on these regulations. The Department of Law has instructed that during active public comment periods, we are limited regarding additional information we can provide, so that all members of the public are working with the same set of information in formatting their comments. And additionally, I just want to say that this legislative hearing is not a formal part of the agency's public comment process, but anyone testifying or asking questions today is encouraged to file their questions or comments directly to the agencies in the same method as the general public, so that the agency record would include these and be clear. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. I appreciate that opening statement. Are there any questions for Mr. Donnelly about those that opening statement for any clarifying points? Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. Deputy Commissioner, you listed other states that have similarly legalized ATVs onto roads. Do you have the dates or length of time that any of those states have allowed that?
Through the chair, I do not know the specific time frames for those laws in other states.
Okay. And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
We have a note that looks like it's from DOT, and they list, so the two agencies do not show the same states as having those. And I'm wondering if there was different criteria for analyzing it. The DOT memo says, for instance, Wyoming with a special permit, or Washington 35 miles per hour or less. So I was just wondering if your list of Arizona, Idaho, Montana, South Dakota, and Wyoming were ones that were identical to our state regulation proposal, or just trying to figure out those comparisons.
Through the chair, my understanding is that no other states have provisions that are identical to these, mostly because these include snowmobiles, snow machines. Growing up here, it was always snow machines to me, but snow machines. And the DOT information that I first became privy to it just here a few hours ago, and I'm in the process of reviewing that. I think there's, you know, they may have more information than the other departments may have been accessed to.
Okay. And then I have one more.
Yeah, one more follow-up, and then I'm going to have the other departments make their opening statement, and then we can come back to Mr. Donnelly. But go ahead with your follow-up, Rep. Hannon.
Your cover memo says local governments would be empowered to opt out, and I am wondering if the time frame that they'd have to opt out, and do they have to opt out by specific road, or could the municipality of Anchorage say everything within the municipality if they were opting out?
Through the chair, that is a question of implementation that we would certainly be examining and taking all the public comment into consideration regarding that. Under the current system, municipalities or local governments can provide for the legality of this operation with a simple ordinance, and it isn't a road by road matter unless they chose to make it such.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. So thank you very much. We can come back to Mr. Donnelly if other questions pop up. Next, I'd like to offer the opportunity for Deputy Director Wright, Jenna Wright from the Department of Administration and Division of Motor Vehicles, to make any opening comments if you have anything to say as well, Deputy Director Wright.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Hopkins. For the record, my name is Jenna Wright. I'm the Deputy Director at the Alaska DMV, and I don't have any further comments to add above what Deputy Commissioner Donnelly has said, but I am here to answer questions later on.
All right. Thank you very much, Deputy Director. So finally, we have Deputy Commissioner Leon Morgan from Department of Public Safety. Deputy Commissioner Morgan, do you have any statements for the record to start us off today?
Thank you, Chair Hopkins, for having me. Through the chair, this is Leon Morgan, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety. I don't have a statement to read. I'm here just to echo Deputy Director that we're here to help answer questions. And thank you for having us. I appreciate this opportunity, and I'll be standing by for questions.
Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Morgan. Appreciate that availability today. Are there any questions from the committee members for anybody about what has been stated today so far? I don't see any from members of the committee, so I would like to ask a question by myself. These are going to be implemented road. These people, cars, and or rather ATVs and off-road vehicles are going to be operated on the roads themselves. Is there a reason that the Department of Transportation was not included in the crafting and implementation of these regulations?
Through the chair, would you like me to take a shot at that?
That works for me, Deputy Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The regulatory process gears off of what department has jurisdiction over the specific regulations being proposed or amended. And the Department of Transportation does not have regulations directly related to this issue. And so that it fell upon the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Administration to be the lead agencies in this.
Thank you very much for that. Additionally, on the same line of questioning, the Department of Public Safety regulation and comment opportunities appear to be going through the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, or Wildland Troopers, the brown shirts, colloquially saying. Why was it not done through the state troopers and instead done through the Alaska Wildland Troopers?
Through the chair, this is Leon Morgan, DPS Deputy Commissioner. As simple as we have a lieutenant at headquarters, we have a cadre of headquarters staff here, and the lieutenant, Katrina Malm, was available to handle this regulatory side to proffer this kind of this process. So to be very frank, I wouldn't read anything into it divisionally. She's a member of the Department of Public Safety. She's a lieutenant in headquarters, and she's just assisting us with aggregating the public comment period.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Morgan. Will that impact who is who will be enforcing these regulations and the rules that are put into place on the highways and roads themselves?
Chair Hopkins, all Alaska Wildlife Troopers and Alaska State Troopers are state troopers. And so, no, just generally, they both divisions have fully sworn state troopers that enforce all laws and regulations in the state of Alaska.
Thank you much, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Since the Colonel Morgan, Lieutenant, I can't remember your first title.
He's got Leon, that's fine.
Mr. Morgan doesn't sound right. Could you speculate, or do you know right now, of troopers' workload, how much of it is safety checks for street legal compliance, lights don't work, blinkers aren't there, those kinds of things? Or are those only done by troopers in the course of other stops for other reasons?
Through the chair, that was Representative Hannon. Thank you for that question. I would say very generally that, as we've seen, as you all know, I think you're on our public safety subcommittee, we're working to build our troopers back up to levels we've seen in the past. And in the past, we've had units like an expanded Bureau of Highway Patrol that was more focused on traffic enforcement and those kinds of safety checks, as you refer to them, would most likely fall under those things. So today our posture is more those checks are, I think, the second part of what you said, by just virtue of us conducting traffic stops and doing our work as prescribed to us by calls for service.
Follow-up?
Thank you. Would you anticipate, and of course we're only talking about where troopers would have jurisdiction if the regs were in place, would it require additional work for troopers? Would you anticipate an increasing trooper workload for enforcement that ATVs were complying with the, I think I'm going to use the phrase, street legal requirements of the regulations?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, and this isn't sort of a dodge, I honestly don't know at this point. I would say that people, again, you have to be licensed to operate these vehicles on the streets as proposed. And so I would make the calculation that those who are licensed are already operating motor vehicles on the road, and we are already enforcing motor vehicle laws on the road. So it's not as though there would be a new cadre of vehicle operators that are currently prohibited from operating a vehicle on the road. We're just changing the kind of vehicle they can operate on the road. So I would hold off from saying that it's going to dramatically increase our workload without seeing any kind of data that would tell us that. And I offer you that analysis just because, again, it's not like we're saying, you know, a bunch of juveniles can drive an ATV on the road. That might increase the level of use of the road itself. But since you still have to be a licensed driver today, as you would in the future, I don't know that we would see more participants on the road. I think we would just see different vehicles on the road.
Thank you.
I see Representative Sponholz has a question on the Teams meeting. Representative Sponholz?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Hopkins. I think this is a question for Deputy Commissioner Donnelly. Why did the administration choose to introduce regulations that would require communities to opt out rather than leaving the issue to local communities?
Through the chair to Representative Sponholz. The actual regulation does allow and does empower local communities to choose whether they want to allow this form of vehicles on their roads or not. It specifically provides them with that opt-out provision. So it in no way limits their ability to choose or not. It simply changes the overall presumption from one that's against the utilization of these types of vehicles to one that's in favor of it. And so that, you know, because currently they could opt in if they wanted to, now they can opt out if they want to.
Yeah, I think then my question is, why is it that the administration chose that particular policy call? Because it is very different to go from an opt-in to an opt-out. It starts with the assumption that we want, that we want communities to be able to do that, and there is some potential liability that comes with that, and our constitution is strongly in favor of local government. And so I'm just wondering what was the problem that you were trying to solve that you felt like an opt out was the better solution than leaving it as an opt in currently?
Through the chair to Representative Sponholz. Well, there are areas of the state that do not have local government, and so there was no ability for anybody there to opt out. Additionally, my understanding is that there were groups and individuals that had been requesting this type of initiative I don't know exactly for what period of time, but I've been told that there was folks that were requesting it and groups that were requesting it.
Follow up. So who were the groups and communities that were requesting it?
Yeah, I don't know that, but I could try to, I'd certainly pass that on and try to get that information for you.
Yeah, I think that's important. Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you very much. And if you supply that to the committee, we can make sure my committee aide, we can make sure to disperse that to the entire committee. Representative McCabe has a question.
Yes, sir. Deputy Commissioner, I'm interested to know if you have an idea of how many centerline miles or how many miles of dirt road or gravel road are affected versus paved road. I mean, I think we're all looking at this and saying, holy cow, we're going to have four-wheelers driving down the Glen or the Steese or somewhere. And I don't think that's the case. I think that this has to do with back road, gravel roads in rural Alaska for the most part, such as my district or Talkeetna, or where you might want to jump on your four-wheeler and drive down to your neighbor's house a couple miles down the road, and you have a choice of doing it in the mud on the ditch, in the ditch, in the mud, or drive down the gravel road, which probably has one or two cars an hour. So is there a way to tell, sort of differentiate what we're talking about as far as gravel road and paved roads and that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative, I did notice that there was some additional new information from the Department of Transportation, some estimates about the mileage that might be impacted, but I had no direct personal knowledge of how many miles of road would be one way or the other. The choice that these regulations propose is to base it on the speed limits on the roads, and so that it would only impact those roads where the speed limit was below 45 miles below 45 miles an hour would be the only roads that this would apply to allow these type of vehicles to operate on. I see Deputy Commissioner Morgan would like to address that.
Certainly, Deputy Commissioner Morgan, take a stab, and then McCabe has a follow-up.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I'm just reading the email I think we've all received from DOT today. DOT's estimate is that out of the 5,635 centerline miles maintained by DOT, 1,900 of those miles would be affected, so under 50%. So, yeah, 5,600 miles and about 1,900 of those fall into the category 45 miles an hour or less, according to the DOT email I think we've all received today.
Certainly. And just before you ask that follow-up, Representative McCabe, I do want to direct your attention to another very, very small print that I believe was dropped on your desk. If not, on BASIS, there's a document broken down by district where you can go to your district and find out which specific roads would be impacted by this and how many miles of that road and then total for your district you can find on there. DOT did a good job of putting that together. You had a follow-up, Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And so just to be clear, I saw the 1,900, which is like less than a third or just over a third. But I'm really curious how many of those 1,900 miles are just gravel roads out in the boondocks. I assume most gravel roads are under 45 miles an hour. You know, there are some roads such as Big Lake where I live that are paved that are 45 miles an hour. But there's other means to do that. I don't know. I'm struggling with this one because I think that we're talking about, I see this big presentation and we're talking about paved roads and that sort of thing, and I don't see it that way. I see it as a more of a convenience factor for somebody that lives out in the boonies to, instead of having to take their you know, big plow truck out, they can jump on a snow machine, drive down the road, or jump on a four-wheeler. So I'd be interested to know if there's a way to differentiate the paved roads from the gravel roads, or if the DOT has even gone that far. I don't know.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. That I do believe that would be impacting Department of Transportation, who is not on the call, as we discussed earlier, and we can reach out to them to see if they can break that out for us, but that was one of the reasons that I believe it would have been important to have DOT as part of this, especially also dealing with federal funds for different roads, as they mentioned in their email today. I'm going to ask a quick follow-up on that, and then I'll get to you next, Representative Sponholz. In terms of how communities can implement their own level of implementation for this new regulation, I know that my community, the borough of Fairbanks, has a number of 45-mile-an-hour roads in its borders that are four- or five-lane roads that are fully paved and within urban, what I would qualify as the urban center. How would but they don't have road powers. The Fairbanks borough is a second-class borough, and they don't have road powers. How would a municipality like that be able to opt out if they do not have road powers within their charter or expanded by voters? Deputy Commissioner Donnelly, if you want to take a stab at that. You're on mute, Deputy Commissioner.
I apologize.
No worries.
yeah, that's the kind of comment we're looking for in this process. These are draft regulations. I'm sure that there are going to be issues like that that will be raised by the public comment process that we will need to examine and properly address. And that's an example of one of them.
All right, thank you. Representative Sponholz, you have a question.
Yeah, I guess I have a question, I guess, for Deputy Commissioner Morgan. You said earlier that you thought that the number of vehicles on the road would stay about the same because there's the same number of licensees, and we're just adding new vehicles that they could use. But I could imagine that a lot of households like mine, in my household, we have sometimes as many as six drivers. We have three regular vehicles, but we also have two ATVs, and we've got two snow machines. And I don't think that's an uncommon scenario for a lot of Alaskan households. I see you nodding. You probably have a similar scenario. And so I could imagine that you end up with a lot of, you know, younger people that then end up taking the ATV or the snow machine to run errands when the adults, for example, in their household, or the more senior members of their household, have the vehicle. Was there any kind of, you know, an assessment done or a study done to sort of evaluate the risk associated with that?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, no, I did not participate in any assessment to that level is what you're saying. Those are very good comments and well received. My earlier statement was just a very broad analysis of, again, adding any kind of operating cohort to the road that we're not doing. I know some of the feedback has been, you know, we're 10-year-olds could drive an ATV, for example. That's still illegal. However, your comments are well received, and I appreciate you providing them.
Follow up. Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe this is a question then for Deputy Commissioner Jenna White. Then, you know, if we, we probably know the number of licensed drivers that we have in the state of Alaska, and we know the number of licensed vehicles in the state of Alaska. How many licensed drivers do we have, and how many licensed vehicles do we have? I think that we need to understand kind of the delta between those two numbers before we can really understand potentially the implications of this and the cost implications for enforcement, frankly, as well as safety.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Sponholz, that would be an excellent point of data to consider, which the division does have. Just not necessarily in front of me. So I'd be happy to follow up with the committee after the hearing.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
That's really helpful.
Certainly. Yeah. Thank you, Division Director Wright. We'd be happy to send that out to the committee as well. Representative McCabe had a question.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So what I'm curious of is this regulation will require that those operating a four-wheeler, say, or a Razor, maybe a side-by-side on the road, have all the turn signals, all the lights, and be licensed. So I know that there are a number of accidents, ATV accidents, that were maybe a large number of ATV accidents now that are caused by an ATV or four-wheeler or side-by-side operating illegally on the road. So I'm wondering if and maybe this might be implementation, I don't know, but maybe I'll try to phrase it. I'm wondering if they see a decrease in those kinds of accidents because of the requirement to have lights, signals, headlights, brake lights, helmets, and a license to operate on the road legally, if it will actually decrease the number of accidents. In other words, we're going to make it legal and we're going to restrict it. And will that decrease the number of accidents from four-wheelers operating illegally on the road? Does that make sense?
I believe it does. Deputy or Division Director, are you able to answer that? Or maybe Deputy Commissioner Morgan?
I'll try to take that, Mr. Chairman.
Go for it, Deputy Commissioner.
I'm in a House meeting. I'm in my old committee room. I went back to my old title. This is Deputy Commissioner Donnelly. I'm cautious that to comment on that would be some sort of indication of that might be inappropriate while this is open for public comment in the regulatory process. We have to be careful not to try to influence public comment in any way.
Certainly. I appreciate that. Representative McCabe, if you'd like to restate it in a different way, you can think about it or take a stab at it.
Yeah, I'm right on the fence with this. I guess I'm waiting to see the public comment, frankly. And I do know I have a constituent that is a firefighter, and he says that there is an inordinate number of four-wheeler accidents that he has been to from four-wheelers operating illegally on the roads. So I'm wondering if this would be a way to reduce those accidents by putting restrictions on it, brakes, lights, brake lights, all that stuff, and maybe that would be helpful. I don't know.
Certainly. And let me ask a follow-up question of that, and it would be for Division Director Wright. Having to license to be able to drive a snow machine or a hovercraft or a track vehicle to be able to take them on the roads, what is that process going to look like to achieve that driver's license and to maintain it and the vehicle that is available or that they'll be utilizing?
Yes, that's a great question, Chair Hopkins. It would be the exact same that it is today for any other Class D license. So the applicant would need to hold a valid permit if they're under the age of 18. They would need to pass the knowledge test for that. They would need to then pass a road test in an actual car or truck, as is done today at the DMV. They wouldn't be able to do it on the snow machine. It would have to be in a car or truck. So the process would look no different than it is today.
Thank you. So that means that there's going to be a written test, so the book will be amended. Then is that DMV employee going to do a ride-along on the snow machine with that individual through the town that would be utilizing those roads?
Chair Hopkins, that's a great question, and it points to some implementation analysis that we would need to do. With COVID, we have implemented remote solutions using GoPros that we may be able to use in this scenario as well, so that we can monitor the applicant.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I'll have some other questions later on, but we've got a stack of questions coming here. Representative Kronk had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. You know, when I first saw this bill come out, I was more, boy, this is sure leaning towards rural Alaska, where, you know, it's really, there's just communities dominated with ATVs and snow machines, and it's technically illegal for them to use them on the road system. And so that, you know, kind of my thought process there. And then listening to the Rep. McCabe, I think a lot of the accidents happen because they know they're illegal and they're speeding across these roads and stuff. So I don't picture this in the middle of downtown Fairbanks, but I do see this on, you know, because I'm looking through the list of roads, and there's Choke has in numerous amounts of these side roads, and mm-hmm. people are already doing this illegally. So I'm really anxious to hear comments and seeing how we can do this if it makes it legal. Like I said, I don't see this in downtown Fairbanks, but certainly in Choke, this is a mode of transportation. Lots of high school kids use this transportation to get to school. I see both sides of the issue here. So there's one question I had, and is looking at this. It says, any mission control system in good working order? And I'm not sure what that means. on a snow machine or an ATV. So that was kind of a...
Certainly. Division Director Wright, would that be under the auspices of DMV to address that? And can you answer that question?
Chair Hopkins, I believe that would be a DPS question, or I'm not familiar with it.
All right. Deputy Commissioner Morgan, can you talk about how you would be enforcing rules based on exhaust and emission systems on these OHVs?
Well, I believe that the, through the chair, Representative Kroc, I believe what those regulations are referring to is our existing emissions requirements for vehicles on roadways. Essentially, it means you have to have a working muffler.
Thank you for that. Representative Hannon had a question.
Thank you, through the chair. And I think my questions are for Ms. Wright at DMV. I know we currently require snow machines to be registered. Will there be a different registration for a snow machine that you were trying to make, quote, street legal to comply and use with this versus one that you were never intending to drive on roads? And do we know what that cost would be? And I don't know. I don't suspect that we currently register ATVs. I don't own one, so I don't know that. And what, again, would there be a bifurcated cost? So a registration for a street legal ATV versus an ATV that you're never going to take on the road. And what would be those cost differences for the registration of those vehicles to comply with these regs?
Through the chair, that's an excellent question, and again, is something that we're analyzing if there were potential implementation. But what we're looking at is we could do something similar to the way that we put plates on motorcycles. Currently, we do have reflective registration stickers that go on the snow machines. And there would not be a difference in cost between the registration stickers or the registration plate, depending on which direction we went with that.
Follow up.
What about an ATV, through the chair? Is there a cost currently to register an ATV, or what will the cost be under these regulations to register an ATV?
Through the chair, the cost to register an ATV follows the same pricing structure as snow machines. The difference would be that today ATVs are not required to be registered, although you may apply for registration for an ATV. If these proposed regulations went forward, you would be required to register the ATV if you want to take it on the road and make it street legal. So that would be the primary difference there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Sponholz has a question.
All right. Thank you. This question is for Ms. Wright. You mentioned earlier that essentially the process for licensing would be the same for regardless of whether you were going to be driving an ATV or a snow machine or a car or a truck if you were going to do this. Just note that driving an ATV or a snow machine is very different than driving a car or a truck. I've been driving snow machines and ATVs since I was a kid, spent a lot of time off-road, particularly up north of Talkeetna, where my family's had a cabin since before I was born. And it's totally a different animal driving it. Did you ever consider creating a special license or a tag for this rather than just saying that, you know, a regular street license or, you know, car or truck license would be appropriate for this?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, there are two classes of licenses right now. There's a class, well, there's quite a few, but for these purposes, we have a Class D license, which today already covers the driving of an ATV and a snow machine when it is required. We also have what's called a Class R license, which is designated for snow machines and ATVs for off-highway use, but it's also comes into play for the communities that have opted into the snow machine ordinances that are in place today. So the two classes do exist, and there would be no changes to that.
Follow up.
Was there any consideration of just sort of encouraging people to do that rather than using traditional licensing? I thought you said earlier that it would be the same process.
Through the chair, could I just inject here?
Certainly, Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Donnelly.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Donnelly. We have to be cautious about discussion of the deliberative process that was behind these regulations. So while we can talk about what they say, at this point of time, we shouldn't be talking about the process that went to how to get to these draft proposals.
Representative Sponholz, I'm going to ask a quick question to follow up on that, but if you want to take a different stab at it when I'm done, please feel free. I'll give you that time. So I have a Class D license for driving my car and my truck. Now, would I need to go get a different Class D license to be able to take my hovercraft onto the roads around Fairbanks, or would I need to go get another separate license to make sure I have had the training and I'm a good enough hovercraft driver?
Chair Hopkins, if these regulations went into effect, you would not need to go get a new license. Your existing Class D would cover you using your hovercraft.
Thank you very much. Representative Sponholz, did you want to take a stab at reasking your question, or did that help answer what you were getting to?
I think that the answer was helpful. I guess I'm just personally very concerned about safety. Mm-hmm. It's a very different thing driving an ATV or a snow machine. And, you know, you can take a corner in a car going a lot faster than you can on an ATV. And, I think it's a different animal. And it concerns me when I think about a lot of what I imagine will be a lot of kids, out riding their families' ATVs and snow machines on main roads where people are driving really fast. I support the effort to make it easier for people in rural Alaska to be able to use their snow machines and ATVs. I think we should support, living a rural lifestyle in every way, but I do have a lot of concerns. I feel like this particular proposal is way too broad. It's not really carefully crafted to solve the problem that it's proposed to solve. So that's just an editorial comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Sponholz. And I want to make something clear and ask a question before I get to your question, Representative Kronk. In the proposed regulations under 13 AAC 40-010A, it would add a new paragraph to read and define what an all-purpose vehicle is, because this regulation no longer uses ATVs or off-highway vehicles. It creates a new classification of an all-purpose vehicle. And I'll go ahead and read this. An all-purpose vehicle means any self-propelled vehicle designed primarily for cross-country travel on land and water, or on more than one type of terrain and steered by wheels, treads, skis, or any combination thereof, including vehicles that operate on a cushion of air, vehicles commonly known as all-terrain vehicles, all-season vehicles, and utility terrain vehicles. Quote, all-purpose vehicles, close quote, does not include an off-highway vehicle as defined in subsection 30. Can you please comment on what that subsection 30 does not include for what would be qualified as an all-purpose vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, I could read subsection 30 to you. This is Dave Donnelly.
That works for me, Deputy Commissioner.
Okay. Off-highway vehicle means a vehicle designed or adapted for cross-country operation over unimproved terrain, ice, or snow, and which has been declared by its owner at the time of registration and determined by the department to be unsuitable for general highway use. Although the vehicle may make incidental use of a highway as provided in this title, it does not include implements of husbandry and special mobile equipment.
Clear as mud, Deputy Commissioner.
Sorry.
Representative Kronk, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being that we're talking about driving on roads, doesn't matter what you're driving if you don't know the rules of the road, that's irrelevant. So, and somebody brought up talking about kids. I mean, we're talking about being licensed, so there's got to be an age limit of being able to be licensed. So if I want to see people driving their ATV or snow machine on the road, I sure hope they have a a driver's license suffices for me because that means you know the rules of the road. There's no special license that you're going to have to drive a snow machine or ATV. Those are just things you learn how to drive. So you're following the rules of the, you know, the rules of the road in my perspective there. So, I would say that it's just like, you know, it's pretty much a driver's license. You have to follow the rules of the road if you're going to be on them. You have to stop at the stop signs. What the thing is that interesting is you're really right now, and I'm not a side-by-side expert, but I'm going to say that there's no snow machine or ATV right now that's going to be in compliance unless you do aftermarket stuff because none of them have turn signals, et cetera. And I guess one of my other questions would be, would they be required to have full coverage insurance? Or insurance on those if they're driving on the roadway, just like we do driving our cars. So, but right now, technically, there's no ATV or snow machine I know made that has turn signals and in this stuff. So this would be all aftermarket or the person doing it. So it would basically be an extremely small group of people at the beginning to be doing this. So I'm not sure if I had a question there. I'm just rambling, but there's a lot here. I see it really beneficial for places that are using this right now where they're technically illegal and they're not. This is their mode of transportation. This is it. It's going to work in different places and it's not going to work in places. So I think we need to make sure we have open minds when we're looking at this to make sure we're not just excluding groups of people because it won't work in certain areas. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kronk. Representative McCabe had a question.
I don't know if it's a question so much, Chair Hopkins, and thank you. We don't train, or the DMV or the driver's ed people don't train our children or our driver's ed to pull a trailer or to drive an F-350 dually or to drive a small electric car. In other words, we don't train our drivers to drive different stuff. That's sort of up to them and their parents. A Class M license, you can drive a little Honda 70 or a Honda 125 all the way up to a big Harley electric glide with just that one license. So I'm not sure it's relevant that we are concerned about the difference between an ATV and a car. I know that my truck takes corners way different than my little car does. So I don't know if that's really relevant. I think what's relevant here is that if we're going to operate on the roads, you need to know the rules of the road. You need to know what the double lines mean. You need to know what the dotted line means, what a white line means, what a stop sign means, what a four-way stop means. When you come up to a stop sign, who goes first? That's the relevant part of this, I believe, Mr. Morgan could correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking that that's the safety aspect or the relevant part of this whole issue here. Or a hovercraft. I mean, you didn't take a special ed. There's nobody that taught you how to drive your hovercraft. You sort of taught yourself, right?
We wish.
If I go get myself a hovercraft, I'll certainly make sure it has turn signals and one headlight. On that note...
Brakes, too.
Yeah, and brakes. Don't know how you brake at 45 miles an hour coming up to a stop sign as the yellow light hits. Division Director Wright, you correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't have a hovercraft and I don't have a motorcycle. Are you required to get a specific motorcycle license and pass a different test to get your motorcycle driver's license?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Chair Hopkins, yes, you are.
Thank you very much. And involved in that test, is there any different rules for following the rules of the road? Or is it to understand that you can drive a motorcycle safely?
It is to understand that you can drive a motorcycle safely. The knowledge test is no different than any other vehicle.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that answer. Representative Hannon, do you have a question?
I do, and I think I wanted to go to Deputy Commissioner Donley, trying to walk that line to not get into the intent but the implementation, and Rep. McCabe started on it, that the difference in my mind, and when I look at the DOT list of roads in my community here in Juneau, like South Franklin, which is a paved downtown street in downtown Juneau, and North Douglas Highway, a paved road out, you know, major commuter line. And I'm wondering whether we have some other, did you look at regulations mm-hmm. instead of based on speed limit, based on condition of road, i.e. gravel roads or trails that don't intersect with major roundabouts? Or because as I look through the list of the my district's communities, and it always startles me, you know, Front Street in Skagway is a state road. The main road through downtown Haines is a state road, and both of them are below 45 miles an hour. But I can think in both those communities where there'd be many roads where no one's going to be concerned if it's an ATV or snow machine going down that dirt road that connects some fields and some large private parcels of land, but driving down Main Street's going to give everyone in the crosswalk a little heartburn. So I'm wondering whether we have other categories of roads besides miles per hour that DOA looked at, or was 45 miles per hour without any other qualifiers seems like a very large lump of roads. And I have concerns over not just the safety, but, gosh, the cost to maintain roads that have a lot of, say, tracked vehicles like snow machines running on them. So the group of roads that it applies to, whether you are there other ways to group them that could get to the issue you're trying to solve?
Through the chair. This is Dave Donnelly, Deputy Commissioner, DOA. I can't speak to what was considered in the deliberative process, but as to the question of are there other ways to lump roads, I would say there are. When I wrote the Mandatory Auto Insurance Act for the state, I utilized a traffic count minimum to determine whether or not the act was effective in particular localities. And that continues to this day, that traffic count number in the statute that applies to when the Mandatory Auto Insurance Act applies or doesn't. There's other categories of roads that are based on funding, such as the National Highway System. And the Department of Transportation would probably know a lot more than I do about other possible categories of roads.
Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Drummond had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of scratching my head and trying to figure out how this is going to work in a city like Anchorage. The list of roads in my district include things like Minnesota Drive, on-ramps and off-ramps, C Street, Spinard Road, and all these folks that own these off-road vehicles live in residential neighborhoods, which there are hundreds of miles of in Anchorage, and they're all under 25 miles an hour. Are DOT's regulations intended to allow traffic of off-road vehicles on residential streets in urban areas like Anchorage? Or are you limiting your regulations strictly to DOT-maintained roads, which is what the list of roads in my district that I've been given includes?
Through the chair, these, and to the representative, these regulations cover all roads in the state of Alaska. It's a reversal of the existing presumption so that these types of vehicles, when properly licensed and insured and operated by a properly licensed individual, would be able to be used on all those roads unless a local government opted out of allowing that.
Thank you.
Certainly, and on a follow-up to that, if a local municipality is not able to opt out based on the powers that they have, how would that be addressed in these regulations?
And once again, Mr. Chairman, Dave Donnelly, Department of Administration. That is a comment that we are going to take into consideration. That has been expressed multiple times and raised. And as with all public comments, we're going to take that into careful consideration as we move forward with any amendments or additional provisions within the proposed regulatory package here.
Thank you much. And I'd like to ask a question that Representative Prox dropped off earlier in the committee meeting, and it has to deal with liability insurance. So I'll ask it in an implementation way. What sort of liability insurance and it would a driver of an all-purpose vehicle need to have in order to operate it legally? I believe that's probably a DMV question.
Yeah, I can let Jenna answer that, or I could answer it, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, there is a statute that determines what vehicles must have liability insurance, and that statute is not changed by these regulations. So those same vehicles would be that statute would be applicable to them with or without these regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. Can you please supply the committee with what that statute citation is? And on that note, does that statute citation for what is allowed to be legally operated on a road include all the definitions under an all-purpose vehicle?
Mr. Chairman, Dave Donnelly, Department of Administration, the statute refers to motor vehicles. But Jenna, did you want to elaborate on that at all?
Yes, Chair Hopkins. Deputy Commissioner Donnelly is exactly right. It's AS 2015-11B that provides that every person exercising control of the vehicle is required to have mandatory vehicle insurance.
So is that with a specific license, or do I need to have that type of liability for my four-wheeler that I use to plow my driveway or drive down my to my neighbor's house at this time?
So the difference is if you're operating the motor vehicle on the road, that would not apply to a snow blower, as you said.
And so in that statute, and I'll read it later, but is specific the motor vehicle specific to operations on a road or simply of a motor?
Yes.
Okay. So I wouldn't need to get that license, that liability insurance under 2815-11B before I'm legally allowed to operate an all-purpose vehicle on a roadway.
Yes, that's correct. I think the terminology is highway, vehicular, way, or public property.
All right, thank you. Are there any other questions of members of the committee at this point? All right, I'll jump in there. At this point, we're looking at the definition of an all-purpose vehicle. Are there any weight limits that are associated with it? For example, can I take my 14,000-pound track vehicle that I use to go hunting and take that on a roadway?
Mr. Chairman, this is Dave Donnelly. Not knowing all the DOT regulations for road utilization, I wouldn't be able to answer that question. There's nothing in these regulations that restricts weight limits, but I think that falls under the Department of Transportation.
Thank you, Mr. Donnelly. That sounds like there would be regulations under DOT's auspices that would be impacted by these new regulations.
I don't think... through the chair, to the chair. I don't think I would characterize it so much as being impacted by these regulations, because anything that DOT currently has for weight limit restrictions, which I'm just generally familiar with, not specifically familiar with, would certainly also apply to anything being operated on public roads.
Thank you much, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Sponholz has a question.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just looking for an updated statute reference. 2815-11B is actually about licensing of drivers. What's the statute for liability insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I'm sorry, I was just getting ready to correct that. It's actually 2822-11A. I'm sorry.
No worries at all. Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you.
So at this point, we were supplied a letter or an email today from the Office of the Wasilla Mayor. It came in at 1:36 p.m. And I believe it's been sent, provided to the other committee members. They asked that we read it into the record, please. On behalf of Mayor Ledford and Chief Smith, the proposed regulation does not make sense in an urban environment such as Wasilla. This would create a huge safety problem with ATVs and snowmobiles, snow machines, traveling along with passenger vehicles, pickups, and tractor trailers, hauling freight and heavy equipment on state roads like Park Highways, Palmer-Wasilla Highway, and portions of Knick Bay Road. Urban centers like Wasilla have high traffic counts and is an invitation for conflict and accidents. Other state roads in our area that would be affected include Wasilla, Fishhook Road, Bogard Road, Church Road, and Old Matanuska Road. The city of Wasilla would certainly seek an ordinance to restrict the use of ATVs and snowmobiles on local roads as a safety measure to protect the citizens of our community. I'm sure I read that into the record. Let's see, are there any other questions from the committee for the administration at this time? I would like to thank you. I want to thank the administration for showing up and making themselves available for questions. I'd like to note that as Deputy Commissioner Donnelly stated, the Department of Public Safety proposed regulations are open until April 18th, which means we have 10 days prior to that closure, residents of the state or the members of this committee or the legislature can submit questions to the department at these emails given, asking for specific clarifying questions or questions about implementation of these regulations, and the department is required to give a good faith effort to answer those questions. We will be submitting questions as of close of business tomorrow, which is the when we're going to make sure we get them in. If anybody else wants to submit questions, we can supply that email link to anybody on the committee or for the public. Please contact our office for it. And again, I want to thank the administration for making themselves available. I know in these past month or so, as the regulations have been open, holding public meetings is far harder, and I understand this is not a public meeting, but it is good to air some of these questions that we do have. So thank you again for all of your time today. And at this point, we are going to move along over to the next presenter, which is Dr. Nathan Bells, the associate professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And let's make sure I have this on. I'm just going to take a quick brief at ease real fast. Review of the data and research contained in his presentation. It is my understanding that this document has been submitted as part of the public comment process for the proposed Rocky regulations. And Dr. Bells, please reference page numbers that you have as you are moving your way through the presentation. And if any committee members have questions, feel free to interrupt me and raise your hand, and I'll notice you and make sure the question gets asked. Dr. Bells, please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation. And at this point, we still have about 45 minutes left today, but whatever you don't get to, we will finish on Thursday. Thank you much, Dr. Bells, and put yourself on the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, loud and clear.
Great. My name's Nathan Bells. I'm an associate professor in civil engineering at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I have studied rural transportation issues for almost 20 years. I've been a Fairbanks resident for nearly a decade. I'm a small business owner, a local public committee member, an enjoyer of our beautiful state. I own an all-terrain vehicle and a snowmobile. I rode my snowmobile, colloquially here in Alaska, snow machine, to high school when I lived in the state of Maine, albeit on trails and formalized crossings that were approved by transportation agencies. That is, these crossings were determined by a professionally licensed transportation engineer as having adequate site distances required for driveways, side roads, and other access points and the like. I'm going to try to refrain from injecting my interpretations of the intent of the code, as well as the larger questions I have in general, and submit those through the formalized public comment period, but provide you with the data I have available to me and what I what is an objective analysis thereof. It is without question that off-highway vehicles help to fulfill basic mobility needs for some of the residents of our state. This is certainly true of our most rural and remote communities, those that aren't connected or serviced by formal roads or highways. Anecdotally, I've heard that the cost of shipping an ATV to a rural community such as Nome or Kotzebue can be 4 or 5 times cheaper than an automobile. Mm-hmm. As an example, I provide on slides 6 and 7, the village of Kotzebue, which has a population of 3,245, which was the number in 2016 projected by the U.S. Census Bureau. At that time, there were 604 registered snow machines and only 372 registered passenger cars. In Kotzebue, about a quarter of all traffic-related crashes involve either snow machines or ATVs. 21 crashes involve speeding ATVs on local roadways for the period of 2013 to 2017, which is the current up to the current DMV crash records that we have. OHVs also play a significant role in and have considerable contributions to our tourism and our economy from a recreation perspective. Yet, from a transportation perspective, 30% of our Alaska communities are located on the contiguous highway, which accounts for about 80% of our residents. In general, speed limits in Alaska are 55, unless posted otherwise. 61.5% of AKDOT and PF roads miles are paved. 31% of all road miles in the state are paved, and we were recently given the statistic from AKDOT and PF, which is about 1,900 miles would potentially be affected by these proposed changes. The issues of allowing OHVs on roads is very contentious and a heated topic in Alaska. On slide 8, I show some media from the ban that was proposed in Wasilla in 2016. We've seen this elsewhere since then across Alaska, Bethel, Petersburg being two of the most recent. Now, regardless of public opinion, the data tell us that we have a very serious transportation problem on our hands. The most recent 5-year averages in fatalities and serious injuries involving off-highway vehicles exceed the goals of our Strategic Highway Safety Plan. The Strategic Highway Safety Plan developed by Alaska DOT and PF with input from other state agencies as well. The numbers for off-highway vehicle crashes, injuries, fatalities are increasing, and they exceed the 5-year goals, as well as exceeding the fatalities and serious injuries that we see for bicyclists and pedestrians. Those are shown on slide 10 and 11 of your packet.
Hold on 1 second, Dr. Bells. We have a question from Representative McCabe.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Doctor. And through the chair, I'm curious, you're citing a bunch of accidents here and off-road accidents and that sort of stuff. So how many of these were actually accidents on a road? Is this just the aggregate OHV accidents throughout the state or in Kotzebue, or are these just the accidents that happened on a road, on a state road or on a borough road, or like snow machine accidents, they happen all the time way out in the boonies. Is that included in here, or is it on a road?
Through the chair, that's a great question. The numbers that I'm referencing here deal specifically with crashes and traumas involving those modes on roadways. So specifically, I'll be sharing numbers from the Alaska Trauma Registry and the Department of Motor Vehicle Records. And then from those, these involve crashes, injuries on roadways.
Follow-up, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So on roadways, would that include just crossing a road, like up at Ship Creek, they have the lodge on one side of the road, and everybody crosses the road with their snow machine to get over to the swamp to run. So is it driving on the road, using the road as a mode of transportation, or is it just crossing the road, that sort of thing?
Through the chair, great question. Most of the numbers that I'll be presenting, if it occurred on the physical roadway or on the shoulder, that number would be included here. There isn't necessarily a differentiation between crossing or being used on or in the main traveled way. In some cases, there are, and there are some figures through the Alaska Trauma Registry specifically that give indication of the percentage that happened on the shoulder or using the roadway specifically, crossing or using the roadway specifically.
Representative McCabe has another follow-up.
So thank you, Chair Hopkins. So on the shoulder, are we talking in the ditch where most snowmobile trails are up around Ship Creek and, pretty much all over the place, all around Wasilla, of course, that could be considered, depending on how close it is, the shoulder of the road for the purposes of your data. Is that Is that true, or you know, the ditch is 20 feet from the roadway, but it certainly could be considered the shoulder, I suppose?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that is incorrect. On the shoulder does not include the ditch of the roadway.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bells. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also, this would be a good point to provide some clarification that the Consumer Federation of America, they're a nonprofit organization that deals with like consumer products, all-terrain vehicles, off-highway vehicles being one of those. They define two main categories of off-highway vehicles. Those categories are all-terrain vehicles. They define that as off-road motorized vehicles having three or four low-pressure tires, a straddle seat for the operator, and handlebars for steering control. I provide an example of that on slide 16 of your packet. Recreational off-highway vehicles, ROVs, are defined as being four or more vehicles with low-pressure tires, bench or bucket seating for two or more occupants, automotive-type controls for steering, throttle and braking, rollover protection, occupant restraint, and maximum speed capabilities that are greater than 30 miles an hour. I provide an example of that on slide 24.
Now, Dr. Bells, I have a quick question. This is Representative Hopkins. You were talking about low-pressure tires on those four-wheelers as they travel on roadways. What happens with a low-pressure tire if you have to slam on the brakes going at about 45 miles an hour? And do you know, and I could have asked this question before, although I still see Division Director Wright on the line, so I'll follow up with her afterwards, but what happens to those low-pressure tires at a 45-mile-an-hour abrupt braking speed?
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. OHV tires, as I said, have low tires, which are low pressure. They also have, in general, deep tread tires. Now, we're not talking about aftermarket tires that one could put on that presumably might be street legal, but the tires that one of these vehicles typically comes with. But in contrast, automobile tires have relatively shallow tread and are designed to provide continual grip and release on roadway surfaces. In contrast, those OHV tires are meant to grab off-road terrain, and when operated on roadway surfaces, especially those that are paved, they can act unpredictably. They are prone to coming off the rim because the tires are so low pressure, and the operator can easily lose control of that vehicle, potentially endangering themselves, their occupants, or other users of the roadway.
Thank you, Doctor. And Division Director Wright, are you still online to answer a quick question about the implementation of those tires?
Good afternoon. I'm here, but I don't have very much knowledge on those on tires specifically.
I'm
afraid I don't have much to add there.
No problem, and we can follow up after the committee. But my question would be just to get it on the record and see if you can answer. Does DMV, or as they're licensing and registering vehicles, have any requirement for pressure levels of tires? I know there are tread requirements when it comes to motorcycles and their tires to make sure they're street legal. Is there anything specific to tire pressure levels?
Chair Hopkins, not to my knowledge, but I will follow up afterwards with a more thorough response.
Thank you very much. A question from Representative McCabe.
Thank you. This is for Dr. Bells. You said that they're prone to come off the rim, low-pressure tires. Do you have any data to back that up? I mean, I've ridden four-wheelers for 40 years, also flown airplanes with tire pressure on them that's like 3 PSI, and landed them at 60 miles an hour and jammed on the brakes as hard as I could. Of course, it's on gravel, but I never had them slip, never had four-wheeler tires come off the rim ever, no matter what I did, uphill, downhill, side hill, jamming on the brakes. So I'm curious where that data came from or if that's just an opinion.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative McCabe. That is through the CPSC, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as well as other related agencies. And I will say that is specifically related to paved surfaces. I'm not talking about gravel surfaces. And if it sounds like you've had other experiences, but again, that is, you know, your data point and not the data point of all users and all operators.
Follow up.
Thank you, Chairman. Is that in data, the CPSC stuff, included in your presentation anywhere here?
I don't make specific note of that. Sorry, through the chairman, Representative McCabe, I don't make specific note of that here today, but I can follow up with that information for you later.
I would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bells. If you wanted to forward that information on to me when you get it, I'll make sure the entire committee gets it and we keep it on the record. Please proceed, Dr. Bells.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, geography, built environment, definitions of these vehicles aside, the Alaska Administrative Code specific to operation of off-highway vehicles and snowmobiles on highways hasn't been updated in some time. And I do agree that Title 13 of the AAC dealing with the use of ATVs and snowmobiles, I think, should be updated to reflect the current state of our system and our society. We travel differently in current day and age. Our vehicle fleets are different in this day and age. But in my professional opinion, I think these changes as proposed are potentially dangerous and ill-advised, and the following are the grounds on which I make that claim. Nationwide, crash and injury data indicate that on-road, off-highway vehicle crash victims are twice as likely to incur major trauma as compared to those who are off-road crash victims. On-road fatalities involving off-highway vehicles are 77% more likely to involve alcohol and 44% less likely to have had the operator wearing a helmet than the off-road incidents, those that resulted in fatality. ATV crashes on-road account for 60% of all ATV-related deaths, and ROV crashes on-roads account for 59% of all ROV-related deaths. Concerning Alaska specifically, Alaska had one of the top 10 highest ATV rider death rates on public roads, with 28.6 deaths per 100 million people between the years of 2007 and 2011. Alaska ranks second among U.S. states for number of off-highway vehicle fatalities from 2004 through 2013 when compared to the total vehicle miles that we travel in the state. Alaska has also experienced years where the number of snowmobile-related fatalities on public roads exceeded the number of fatalities involving personal automobiles. Now, multi-agency summits and studies...
Dr. Bells, real fast. Representative McCabe has a question.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. And so, Dr. Bells, you differentiated the twice as likely to have traumatic injuries on-road versus off-road. Did you put a variable in there for speed? You know, if you're on the road, whether it's a gravel road or a paved road, you're likely going to be going faster, smoother surface. You want to get from point A to point B. When you're on a trail, you're probably going slower. So did you put a variable in your equation for speed at all and consider that versus sort of trying to get to the twice as likely just because it's a road answer?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that specific statistic, no, does not account for speed.
Thank you.
Representative Cronk had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick, you gave a bunch of data there. So the Alaska death rate was 28 out of how many people?
It's per 100 million. So that would be, you know, the same number divided for all the states in the nation. So just comparatively, Alaska is in the top 10 highest ATV rider deaths on public roads.
And was there a year expanse there, or is that just?
Through the chair, Representative Cronk, that number specifically, the 28.6, was for the period of 2007 through 2011 specifically. And that number comes directly from a study that was published in 2014 in the Journal of Safety Research.
All right, thank you.
Representative McCabe had another question.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So this is the most current 2011, I guess, and published in 2014. Is that nothing more current than that? I see 2017 here. from the DMV crash record. So I guess I'm just curious. This seems a bit dated for me, and not sure if that makes a difference. But
through the chair, and to address your question, Representative McCabe, we have more recent data, and I'll go on to some of these here in a minute, specifically on the data we have available in Alaska, which includes an analysis of the DMV records, which is current through 2017. We only have through 2017 for the DMV crash records currently.
Thank you.
Thank you much, Dr. Bells. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So there were multi-agency summits that were conducted in the early 2000s to try to address this issue. And I was approached, or I had approached the Department of Transportation in association with the University Transportation Center that we're affiliated with, and was funded in 2017 to conduct a study which was entitled Safety Evaluation of Statewide Off-Highway Vehicle Use in Alaska. The study concluded in September of 2019. It funded two graduate students, Gabriel Fulton and Tristan Sayer, who helped complete this work. The study used a mixed methods approach, and I'll note a few of the significant findings here. So first, related to OHV ownership and registration, we noted that residents are required, under the current regulations, residents are required to register snowmobiles, that is, if they're operating them off of private property. But registering of ATVs is not required, according to the state of Alaska DMV. But ATVs with low-pressure tires may be registered as, quote-unquote, snow vehicles. In 2017, again, you know, this was when we were conducting the study, there were approximately 45,000 registered snowmobiles in the state and 473,000 registered passenger vehicles in Alaska, so roughly 10%. We also looked at borough and city policies on off-highway vehicle use on public roads and right-of-way. You'll see these on slides 32 and slide 33. We noted that 13 boroughs currently default to state provisions. Five boroughs and eight cities were identified as having on-road OHV policies with requirements relating to users, vehicles, time restrictions, and speed limits. For the most part, each of these policies were unique in some way or another from each of the others. Some say that they can't be used within a period of 11 p.m. to 5 a.m. If under 16, they must be under direct supervision of an adult. They must have hard protective headgear, so on and so forth. The existing policies and regulations in these areas, as noted on these slides, and I do apologize, the text is very small, but that they are stricter than the proposed state regulations. Specific to crashes and injuries involving OHVs on roads, the first is was an analysis of the Alaska Trauma Registry. You'll find that on some of those findings on slide 35 through slide 38 of your packet. The Alaska Trauma Registry indicated that 25% of the 1,352 incidents involving ATVs and 18% of the 936 incidents involving snowmobiles occurred on highways and other public roads. That was for the period of 2009 through 2014, which was the most current data we had available at that time. The Alaska Trauma Registry also indicated that trauma was 5 times and 2.5 times more likely for OHV and snowmobile operators, respectively, on roads and trails than on trails and wilderness areas combined. And on-road traumas involving OHVs are more likely to occur in communities that are connected by the contiguous highway system, that is, the ones who aren't remote and rural.
Thank you. Dr. Bells, this is Representative Hopkins. A quick question about planning for local communities. In terms of when communities work across intergovernmental efforts to plan for their community, to plan for transportation within their community, to plan for safety, to plan for motorized and non-motorized access and ability to travel around a municipal area, how do you see these new regulations, if implemented as we know them today, how do you see that impacting those plans and having to get rewritten or not in order to address the regulations?
Thank you for your question, Chair Hopkins. I guess I would ask to refrain from answering that question until the public comment period has ended and we know exactly what the proposed changes are that we're looking at.
All right, thanks. I'll ask you after the 18th. Representative Kronk had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking back at the borough policies and city policies, and this really comes back to what I stated earlier. This is a rural versus urban. If you look at all the borough and cities, if they're in rural areas, they're allowed to drive on their city roads, you know, and obviously the state doesn't allow that, but all these rural areas on city roads allowed. So, again, I'm just bringing up the point, putting it on record that it becomes an urban or a rural decision here. And again, I can't picture this in the middle of Fairbanks or Wasilla or downtown Juneau or somewhere, but in rural Alaska where this is a fact of life, this is the transportation, it is actually allowed on the city roads. Just making a point. Thank you.
Absolutely, Representative Kronk, and that is sort of the Alaska that we know and love, the ability to travel around those low-speed roads, whether it's Ukiagvik or Huna that I saw on that list as well. But it looks like Wasilla stops short of an ATV ban and approving the new rules, as you put on an early slide, and I wanted to go back to a question I asked of the department where they didn't have any questions for how the Fairbanks Borough would be able to opt out of those these regulations if they're implemented as we are today and they do not have road powers. And the road in front of my high school is a 45-mile-an-hour four-lane road with a turning lane in the middle that is 45 miles an hour and paved. The roadway of Airport Road crosses from the city of Fairbanks that does have road powers into the borough of Fairbanks, which does not, yet it is a four-lane divided highway that is 45 miles an hour and paved as well. So this is absolutely an urban question. And in practice and in life that we have in Alaska, rural areas such as Tok, such as Utqiagvik or any other communities, that is a way of life and that's understood. But that's why one of the questions asked before was opt-in versus opt-out, because many have different ways of life than urban areas that these would impact, because it wasn't dealing with what was Representative McCabe mentioned, gravel roads versus paved roads or traffic counts or anything else like that. So that was my main concern with this opening up, that this is not community by community but statewide. Dr. Bells, would you like to please proceed with your presentation? Representative McCabe had a question before you get started.
So thanks, Chair Hopkins. So Dr. Bells, one more question occurred to me. So you have any idea how many miles of road? I mean, typically when we talk about accidents, you can talk about the aggregate accidents like you're talking about. At some point, we need to start talking about, hey, you know, these ATVs traveled 100 miles of road, and for every 100 miles of road, there was one accident or two, however that works, or how many hours of use, or is there any, you know, in Alaska, we use these ATVs way, way, way more than any other state, and I'm looking at our total ATV deaths from OHV compared to, say, Texas or even Florida or New York, and we're way below them in total fatalities, way below them. We're like below 50% of the rest of the states, and I am sure that we use our ATVs and our OHVs way more than Florida or Illinois, and I'm from Minnesota. I could probably tell you Minnesota as well. So I'm curious if there was any variable, you put a dummy variable in there or anything to take that into account, the amount of time that we spend on four-wheelers versus the total fatalities?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, that's a great and valid question. The data at hand, we do not have information to suggest the number of hours used by these modes. They, you know, since they're not required to be registered as with automobiles, conventional automobiles, personal automobiles, where you're indicating, you know, the current mileage on your vehicle, we simply don't have either mileage data or the amount of time spent on those vehicles. I will note here a couple of statistics from the pilot study we did, which was to count at select locations the number of vehicles using the roadway, crossing the roadway, as an attempt to start getting at some of those numbers, but you do make a very good point, which is we don't have that data by which to normalize the fatality rates, the injury rates, as we do with conventional automobiles.
Thanks for that. Normalize was the word I was looking for.
Thank you, Representative McCabe. Please proceed, Dr. Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then specifically, or I guess then related to the DMV crash records, which you'll find a few summaries of on slide 39 through slide 42, there were 120 reported on-road crashes involving off-highway vehicles in Alaska. That's from the DMV crash records. So 120 for the year of 2016 specifically. The 17 most recent years of the DMV records, if you average across that time period, there were 80 reported crashes on average per year involving off-highway vehicles and snowmobiles on roadways. The DMV records indicate that there were a total of 255 off-highway vehicle and snowmobile incidents on roads between the years 2008 and 2012. So that's the 5 years prior to the data you're looking at right now. But for the 2008 to 2012 period, 30% of those crashes resulted in serious injury or fatality. 17% involved operators 16 years of age or younger, and 40% occurred at intersections. Looking at the slide you're looking at currently, which is the 2013 and 2017 five-year period, there were 227 off-highway vehicle and snowmobile incidents on roadways, 40% of which resulted in serious injury or fatality, 20% of which involved operators 16 years of age or younger, and nearly 30% occurred at intersections. That's slide 39 and 40 specifically in your packet. The highest frequencies of crashes, which you'll see the statewide crashes on slide 41, and then crash density maps on slide 42 of your packet. The highest frequency of crashes for the 2009 through 2017 period. Now, these are the years that we have geolocated information for, occurred in Anchorage. So there were 66 in Anchorage, 88 total in Matsu, 44 total in Fairbanks, while the highest crash densities were, as you might expect, in smaller communities, right? Smaller spaces, smaller geographic extents. That being Utqiagvik, which had a total of 46, Point Hope with a total of 23, Kotzebue with a total of 18, and Bethel with a total of 15. Of those, 61.5% of the statewide on-road OHV crashes occurred on paved roads, 28% of those occurred on state-maintained roads and highways, and nearly a quarter of the on-road OHV crashes were a result of overturn and rollover. 36% were from striking another motor vehicle in transport.
Dr. Bells, we had a question from Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. I actually think he just answered that question I was going to ask. Thank you.
All right, there you go. Never mind. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We also conducted a media discourse analysis. Basically, it's just a fancy way of saying we read a whole bunch of news media. And you'll find some screenshots of that on slide 43 through slide 45, I believe. So what we did was track national media for the period of July 1st through 2007, from July 1st, 2017 through June 30th, 2018. The analysis yielded, again, this is nationwide, 1,327 articles. In total, 812 of those dealt with on-road OHV use. 18 specifically were from Alaska. 482 of those articles covered on-road incidents that either resulted in severe injury or fatality. 297 covered issues related to on-road policies, the passing or the not passing thereof. 33 articles discussed issues related to education about on-road use. Of the 10 of the 18 articles that we found for Alaska, 55% so 10 of 18, 55% involved OHV fatalities. That number is not specific to roads. That was just all OHV fatalities in the state that was included in some sort of news media outlet. So then to get to Representative McCabe's point about amount of use or time spent on these modes, we conducted a field study, which you'll see some summaries of on slide 46 through slide 54. We used publicly available road and trails layers to identify connectivity and possible extent of OHV user routes. From that, we selected 14 locations for this pilot counting study. We used day-night cameras with motion detection to capture raw footage that we then processed using a semi-automated algorithm that my graduate student Tristan Sayer developed to extract still images and do the raw counts. You'll see some still images from that on slide 49 of your packet. Each of those still images was then inspected manually to determine relevant information such as the location that the vehicle was, what type of vehicle it was, what were the operator characteristics, and you'll see some of those summarized on slide 50 through 54. In some locations, as many as 60 off-highway vehicles were observed using or crossing a highway in a single day. Of the 447 total observations, which was over the equivalent of 47 days, so that was about 1,100 hours of video that we took, 53% were observed to be using the road unlawfully. That is not crossing, that is that was actually using the road or on a paved shoulder. 70% of operators were not wearing helmets, and 17% were carrying passengers on vehicles not intended to carry passengers.
Thank you very much. Dr. Bills, you have a question from Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So can we go back to that slide with the six pictures on it? Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I'm curious, of these six pictures, and I'm still struggling with the in the ditch versus on the shoulder question, I see the top left picture, I see some on the shoulder all the way in the back, and the two in the foreground, or at least the one in the foreground and the one right behind him, are on a trail, right? Would you agree with that?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, correct. So some of the vehicles in the images provided here are technically using the road lawfully or using the right-of-way in a lawful manner, while some others are not.
Okay. Thank you.
Please proceed, Dr. Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess to provide some professional concerns related to the proposed changes, first is that the proposed changes are directly contrary to the Alaska Strategic Highway Safety Plan that was developed by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, could potentially have implications for highway design, and I would refer you to that document and look specifically at Strategy 3 that's defined in the Strategic Highway Safety Plan. That the changes also aren't reflected in the recommended action steps of the Strategic Highway Safety Plan. These were strategies that were developed by many stakeholders, which also included the Alaska State Troopers. I will also note that Lieutenant Carson of Alaska State Troopers Office from the Northern Region stated on public record in a FAST Planning Committee meeting that troopers are not able to pursue an operator of a snowmobile or an OHV if they flee from a traffic stop. This implies potentially that under these proposed changes, not all users of the roadway would be subject to equal and fair enforcement of the law. He also indicated that supplementary changes changes to the Alaska Administrative Code aren't complemented by changes in the Alaska statute, which then would make enforcement problematic or erroneous. But more generally, I would note that the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, which I referenced earlier, warns against operating ATVs on public roads, and they state specifically to not drive, quote-unquote, do not drive ATVs on paved roads. So you'll see some of these quotes on slide 56 of your packet. The Specialty Vehicle Institute of America also states that, quote, ATVs are intended for off-road use only, never operate an ATV on public roads, and always avoid paved surfaces. ATVs are not designed for use on public roads, end quote. They also state, quote, ATVs are not designed to be used on paved surfaces because pavement may seriously affect handling and control, end quote. They also state, quote, on-road vehicles must be manufactured and certified to comply with U.S. Department of Transportation Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. Since ATVs are not intended to be used on road, they are not designed, equipped, or tested to meet such standards, end quote. The Consumer Federation of America explicitly states that off-highway vehicles are not designed for roadway use and therefore, from a purely vehicle characteristic standpoint, quote-unquote, should not be allowed on public roads. The CFA has signed on to over 230 letters with such intent in 26 states since 2014. They advocate against increasing recreational off-highway vehicle access to roads. And lastly, Section 13 AAC 40.010B30, as was read earlier, it stated in there, quote, that off-highway vehicles, quote, are determined by the department to be unsuitable for general highway use.
Thank you. Dr. Bells, we have another question from Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So, Dr. Bells, once again, I'm struggling a little bit with your study of the accidents on the roadway, and I'm unclear. I wear a helmet all the time in my snow machine or on my four-wheeler, so I think Alaska law allows you to not wear a helmet, if I'm not mistaken. And so how many of those accidents, and maybe this is another normalized question, but how many of those accidents on the roadway would have, fatalities on the roadway would have been prevented had the four-wheeler driver been wearing a helmet? You probably don't even have any idea of that, or maybe you do, I don't know.
Is that possible to drag out of those stats, Dr. Bell?
So, through the chair, to answer your question, Representative McCabe, though I can't make a statement about which of those crashes that resulted in serious injury or fatality might have been prevented by by wearing a helmet, I can tell you that roughly 40% of the crashes documented in the DMV indicate that no helmet was worn.
Follow-up?
So I guess I'm wondering if this is a helmet issue in not so much a roadway issue. So I'm wondering if they were wearing a helmet on the road, if they would have survived, or maybe if they were wearing the proper equipment on the road like a motorcyclist wears, you know, leathers and a helmet, if it would have been less injury. In other words, I'm struggling to blame this on the road and not on the rider.
So I guess that's my
issue with the study is there's too many potentials for variables in there that we just don't know, such as that.
Certainly, Representative McCabe, you can't know and model exactly what's going to happen each time the person hits a car with their four-wheeler or off-highway vehicle at this point, and what that, you know, rollover capacity might be based on the impact and things like that, because this probably hasn't been studied unless Dr. Bells has already done an in-depth analysis of that. But would you be interested in seeing the regulations put forward a mandatory helmet law?
You put me on the spot.
Yes, sir, I did.
I wear a helmet. How's that?
I'm glad you do.
Yeah.
Kronk, Representative Kronk says she does not.
Yeah.
So this certainly is another implication that we need to delve more into the regulations that they put on, and with my driver's license that I can take and take my theoretical 14,000-pound track vehicle or hovercraft under these regs doesn't require me to know how to drive those vehicles either on the roads.
I have one more question, if I might.
Sure.
So ATV, I don't think the ATV, right at the end, Dr. Bells, you and through the chair, you read a statement about ATVs from CPSC and a few other folks about how they're not to be driven on the roads. And I think ATV has changed. The actual ATV itself has changed significantly from when we first called them ATVs when Honda came out with the three-wheeler. And we still call them ATVs. And there are many, many, many classes now of ATVs, including ones that can actually be driven on the road safely. They got roll bars. They don't have quite as aggressive tread. The Razor, they've got seat belts, sometimes four-point harnesses. They've got signals. They've got mirrors. The roll cage, the whole thing. So and they're called ATVs. So I'm wondering if part of our issue here as well is just having such a generic sort of description of what we're talking about.
Representative McCabe, I would agree that the generic description of what we're talking about is a big concern that I have with this. And if you go back to 13 AAC 40010A and the definition of an all-purpose vehicle, which is a new definition that they're utilizing in these regs and eliminating snow machine, and rather snowmobile, from a lot of these, and the use of the ATV regulations. That is part of the problem with it, is that you don't see any of those on a lot of the different types of vehicles that would be allowed on the highway, and it doesn't sound like they addressed that in the consultation with anybody during the implement or the writing of these regulations. Dr. Bells, did you have any comment about the different types of vehicles out there or the different types of accidents we see at all, or have you not studied that as much?
Through the chair, I would just second what Representative McCabe has said, which is that the nature and the design of these vehicles has changed markedly since we first started referring to them as all-terrain vehicles, and in part the reason why the CFA makes a clear distinction between all-terrain vehicles and recreational off-highway vehicles, so ATVs versus ROVs, them being sort of, blanket referred to as off-highway vehicles. Again, that still, even though they're being defined and classified as such, those three entities, which are in effect tasked with ensuring, you know, that consumers are safe when they're utilizing these types of modes, all say don't use them on roads and don't use them on paved roads.
Dr. Bells, in your research into these regulations, you've looked at statute and you've looked at what the regs say. Is there confusion of the different terms of art or usage of description of these vehicles from an OHV to an all-purpose vehicle to an ATV? Have you seen some problems with how that plays within it, plays between those different definitions and acronyms?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes. I do, because there are several places where even though snow machine is being struck or snow, so first that snowmobile is used in some places, snow machine is used in others. That's a small one. But other places where off-highway vehicle is being struck but shows up in other places. And those are part of my more general comments, which I'm, have submitted through the formal public comment process. So again, I hope those would be addressed, through that process.
Thank you, Dr. Belts. I hope so, too. Representative Hannon had a question for the Department of Public Safety, which I believe is offline, but we'll make sure to get it on the record and ask them afterwards.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Belts referenced that an Alaska State Trooper spoke to enforcement and pursuit, I guess pursuit and enforcement, and I am wondering in the regs whether the Alaska State Troopers have addressed that, what their pursuit and enforcement of snow machines or all-terrain vehicles that would be if these regs went into place operating on roads, and would that pursuit policy change? And I don't know if that's a question to be sent to the public process for DOA on the regulations or just to the troopers, but it certainly provoked some concern for me.
Certainly. Thank you, Representative Hannon. We'll make sure we get that asked either through the question submitted to the regulations or to the department after this meeting. So, Dr. Bells, did you have anything else you wanted to touch on before we wrap up for today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, undoubtedly, I think we would all find a great deal of pleasure in having free rein to use snowmobiles and four-wheelers on our public road system, and I would imagine for that reason alone, there's going to be a considerable amount of public support for these changes. But as a transportation professional, based on the data that I'm looking at, and specifically noting that the percent of on-road OHV crashes that have resulted in severe injury and fatality have been consistently increasing in Alaska, it's clear that our state has a significant safety issue related to the use of off-highway vehicles, or as they're proposed to be re-termed, quote-unquote, all-purpose vehicles. And while other states may have legislation or regulations related to off-highway vehicle roads, and the Consumer Federation of America website does provide a comprehensive list of the other states that do, not necessarily at the state level, but other county and local municipality levels, but in general, allowing OHVs and snowmobiles to use public roads suggests to the public that using the vehicles on roads is safe and responsible, when in fact industry, regulators, and consumer and public health and safety advocates all unanimously agree that OHVs are not safe on public roads, and again, particularly those that are paved. So with that in mind, I think the statement that we heard earlier about allowing Alaskans to safely and affordably travel throughout the state, at least that first part safely, is certainly not supported. Those are my comments, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Bills. I think we had one more question from Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for your presentation. I think I have two questions. Could we get a breakdown of the crashes, accidents in Alaska by age, and if alcohol and drugs were involved with those crashes? Thank you.
Through the chairman, Representative Kronk, I can give you some numbers right now specific to age. For the 2013 through 2017 DMV crash record specifically, so 20.4% of documented crashes involved operators under the age of 16, 30.5% involved operators 16 to 25, 14.6% ages 26 through 35, 9.3% 36 to 45, 10.2% ages 46 to 55, and 3.1% for 55 and older. And I believe, I'm trying to recall now the slides that some of that data may have been on, but it was in the general grouping 39 through 42 of your packet. Alcohol was suspected in 22% of those records.
Thank you, Dr. Bills, for having that at your fingertips. Any other questions for the good doctor of traffic, as you saw from his wonderful Twitter handle? Doesn't look like it, but his contact information was on the final page on the bottom right of his presentation if you do want to follow up with him. I also want to make a scheduling note for this week. On Thursday, we'll be finalizing this committee testimony or questioning by hearing from invited testimony from mayors from across the state who can be impacted. I want to make the opportunity wide open for any committee members. If you have mayors in your area, transportation professionals, people who would like to testify, who have experience either implementing regs like this or looking into them, please reach out to them or encourage our office to reach out to them with the contact information. We'd be happy to make sure that any mayors who this would fall on are available to put their question, their concerns or comments or questions on the record come this Thursday. So we're wide open to make sure people are heard. And before we adjourn, the good staffer Joe Hardenbrook has a comment or
question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the knowledge of the committee, we're scheduled to hear from the city manager of the city of Palmer, the chief of staff to the mayor of the city of Fairbanks, the mayor of the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, and we have also going to be hearing from the mayor of Dillingham. And so if folks have other mayors or local government officials they'd like included, please contact our office.
Absolutely. Want to make sure we have that because we got plenty of time on Thursday. So any further questions or comments before we close today? Thanks, everybody. And we're going to go ahead and adjourn at 3:02 in the p.m.